This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. On today's show, I hate to talk about this, but there are some high-profile stories that have been dominating the news lately that are just insane. The media are twisting themselves into the most bizarre and convoluted reasoning. The world is falling to pieces, and yet what is the big conversation about in the United States? It's about a man who says he's a woman and a white woman who says she's black. That is crazy. What these people are doing is crazy, but the really crazy part of the story is what we're going to talk about today, and that is how people are reacting to these stories. Also, do you know what the fastest growing religious group in America is? It is none of the above. In the coming issue of the Trumpet Magazine, Dennis Leap wrote an article looking at the latest Pew information showing how the nuns are multiplying. And we're going to talk to Dennis about how more and more people are disenchanted with organized religion and how this is affecting the nation's moral fabric. How much power should our government have? Should it be subject to the same laws that the people have to obey? Well, in America today, the answers to those questions are increasingly no amount of power is too much, and no, they can pick and choose which laws to enforce and which to obey. Well, this week marks the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. This is a revolutionary legal document signed in England back in 1215. This charter established the rule of law as opposed to the rule of tyrants, and some foundational principles of freedom that we need to remember. We're going to have a conversation with two men who are working on a documentary about this extraordinary charter, and they say the Magna Carta could be more relevant now than it's ever been. We're also going to answer questions from Trumpet readers, and I'll finish off the show today by giving you a potent key to becoming a better, stronger person. When you're gritting your teeth, just think of it as a smile. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Our top story today gives an amazing picture of just how insane our world is becoming. And before I get started, I want to just apologize for even bringing this up. These stories are all over the news. Part of me just wants to run in the opposite direction, especially considering just how many huge events are taking place in the world today. But these stories are so crazy, and they give an unbelievable picture of the United States right now, morally, what we're interested in, our character as a nation. All of a sudden, Americans are expected to accept transgenderism as normal. A man decides that he's a woman. He had 10 operations on his face to make it look more feminine. Now he wants to be called Caitlin. Now that tells you something right there, that this type of thing is becoming less and less uncommon in our world. I'm sure there have been people doing this for years, but the story is that suddenly anyone who believes that what this individual did is bizarre and not normal is considered out of touch and insensitive and bigoted. Suddenly everyone has decided that this is the brave, courageous, praiseworthy thing. This is beautiful. Your biology doesn't matter. Reality doesn't matter. What matters is what you think. And if you think you're a woman, you're a woman. And anyone who disagrees is a bigot. The media are on board. Politicians are on board. This is the mainstream view. Now, that is an amazing change in America's morals. It's a huge change, a revolutionary change in a very short amount of time. We talked last week about how several states have passed laws that bar psychiatrists from trying to help a minor who has gender confusion to try to help them to have natural gender feelings. And these states can actually prevent parents from getting help for their children. There are doctors who have begun treating gender-confused children with puberty-delaying hormones so that it's easier to give them a sex change surgery later on. And we're talking about drugs that stunt children's growth, that can cause sterility. In today's upside down world, we are told at the same time, simultaneously, that it's wrong to change from homosexual to heterosexual. It's wrong to try to convince someone to change from one to the other, but it's praiseworthy to have physical surgeries to try to change from a man to a woman or vice versa. We're told that your thoughts are a greater determinant of your sex than biological reality is. But at the same time, we're supposed to celebrate when someone tries to surgically change biological reality and then pretends to be something that they're not. That's the world that we're living in right now. And if you don't like it or if you don't agree with that, you are the weird one. Now, I happened to be traveling this past weekend and on the radio, I heard a parody on Rush Limbaugh's program of a white man who called in and said that he's actually black. He doesn't look black, but he knows in his mind that he's black. Now, it was a joke. It was intended to point out just how silly it is that we would accept feelings over physical, provable, objective reality. But then last Friday, parody turned into reality. When Rachel Dolezal, the president of NAACP in Spokane, Washington, she was exposed for having masqueraded as a black woman for 10 years. She's white. She's got blonde hair, green eyes, or she did have. Her parents are white, but she frizzed up her hair. She darkened her skin. She claimed that her dad was a dark-skinned black man. She claimed that she was the mother of two dark-skinned black boys. These are just blatant lies. She knew that they were lies. She claimed that she was raised in South Africa, that her parents disciplined her with baboon whips like those that were used during slavery days. She said that they punished her for having dark skin. It's just all total lies. She claimed to be the victim of several anti-black hate crimes. Police couldn't find any evidence of this. She wrote about how things like 12 years a slave and the Eric Garner death, how that touched her deeply as a black person. I mean, just lie after lie after lie, total deceit, and she's manipulating her way into these positions as a black woman, openly deceiving people in order to gain more favor in these positions. And she even told one of her adopted brothers, don't blow my cover. This wasn't just this was overt deceit. I want to just read a statement from a Victor Davis Hanson article. This was in the National Review yesterday. He said, if whiteness ipso facto earns one advantages over the non-white, why in the world do some elite whites choose to reconstruct their identities as non-white? Now, there are people that say, well, she's just a one-off situation. But the fact is that there are a lot of cases where this is basically someone has tried to prove their liberal bona fides by masquerading as something other than white. Victor Davis Hanson says, would Elizabeth Warren really have become a Harvard law professor had she not, during her long years of academic ascent, identified herself as a Native American? Ward Churchill, with his beads and Indian getup, won a university career that otherwise might have been scuttled by his mediocrity, his pathological untruths, and his aberrant behavior. Why would the current head of the NAACP in Spokane, Washington, a white middle-class woman named Rachel Dolezal, go to the trouble of faking a genealogy, using skin cosmetics and hairstyling, and constructing false racist enemies to ensure that she was accepted as a victimized black woman? It seems pretty clear that she felt like she could gain some advantages as a liberal black woman that she couldn't as a middle-class white woman. And Victor Davis Hanson talks about how really among elites, there are career advantages to identifying as a non-white. Now, you look at this situation and it seems absolutely obvious that this woman has serious problems. This is a woman who took advantage of just how confused society is, especially within certain liberal circles. She had her own head, I'm sure, mixed up with a lot of terrible ideas and thinking that personal truth is just as real as absolute truth, and a lot of liberal racial thinking about victimhood and so on. And she had a whole ball of things that are crazy about our society all rolled into one head. And she's a pathological liar on top of it all. And a lot of people are looking at this case and they're seeing that. They can see this woman is messed up. But here is the really crazy thing. There are other people, and supposedly intelligent people, or at least people who are in prominent positions, who are saying, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe she has a point here, and she's really raising some important questions. I want to just play a little clip from Melissa Harris Perry from MSNBC. Listen to what she said on the air, and the woman that she interviewed as well.
But is it possible that she might actually be black? And the best way that I know how to describe this, and I want to be very careful here, because I don't want to say that it is equivalent to the transgender experience, but there is a useful language in trans and cis, which is just to say some of us are born cisgendered, some of us are born transgendered, but I wonder, can it be that one would be cis black and trans black? That there is actually a different category of blackness that is about the achievement of blackness despite one's parentage. Is that possible?
It's absolutely possible. I mean, why not? I mean, I think that one thing that she said that I found so fascinating was she said her identity is multi-layered and that her identity is very complicated and that she didn't expect for people to understand it easily. And I think what she's alluding to is this sort of perhaps, and again, we don't know that much about the story. You know, we need to hear more from her and more of her personal story. But there certainly is a chance that she identifies as a black woman and that there could be authenticity to that.
She's a liar. She's a liar, and they're talking like this is multi-layered and her reality is more complex and there might be authenticity. She's a liar. Now, NPR had a story on the same thing, and they're talking about how racial identity is a social construct. It's dynamic. You know, the legal definitions change, social definitions of race change. Here's a soundbite from an NPR story.
One of the things this story has surfaced again is the idea that race is a fiction, that it is not a thing that is fixed, that it is a thing that we are always negotiating. And so we're having conversations, even though she may be a sort of imperfect fulcrum for those conversations, we are having conversations very candidly about the messiness of these identities that we all are choosing to some extent. It's not just Rachel Dolezal who's making this decision, or she's making a decision in a very specific way, that we're all sort of choosing to be part of these categories.
So this is nuts. This is the emperor's new clothes. These people are staring at the emperor and they're saying, oh, it's beautiful. What an impressive garment. We see it. We see it. We're the enlightened ones. Anyone who can't see it is blind and they're backward, but we see. What happened to reality? This is so crazy that if I saw it on The Onion, I would think it was a brilliant satire. Just a few days ago, Rush Limbaugh was doing this as parody. But this is happening. This is real. And this is what happens when you throw out absolutes. This is what happens when you don't care about the truth. It starts getting ridiculous. And we've been talking about how lawless our society is becoming with these situations where people are protesting and rioting based on obvious lies, hands up, don't shoot, those types of fictions. When you don't put a high value on truth, then you start believing lies. When you reject absolutes, you get to the point where you're rejecting quantifiable facts. You're rejecting reality. The land of the free is becoming Alice in Wonderland. You can read about this in our article up today on thetrumpet.com.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Do you know what the fastest growing religious group in America is? None of the above. The latest Pew poll shows how the nuns are multiplying. In 1950, it was 2% of the adult population. And over the next 57 years, that number rose to 16%. But in the 7 years since, just the last 7 years, it's gone all the way up to 23%. Now, America was built on the protection of religious freedom. America has no state-sponsored religion. That's a huge blessing. We can't take that for granted. And America has a long history of exercising that religious freedom. But this trend is actually quite new. The rise of people who basically don't want to be part of any organized religion. And in the coming issue of the Trumpet magazine, Dennis Leap wrote an article looking at this trend. I talked to Dennis about it, why this is happening, what the causes are, and how this is affecting our nation's moral fabric. How is the religious landscape in the United States changing?
You know, America's had an interesting history with religion. And we know that this country was founded by people who believed that people should be following the Christian principles outlined in the Bible. They believed that this would be a moral society. They believed people would follow the Ten Commandments. However, they did not establish a state-sponsored religion because persecution usually comes about. So America has had this incredible freedom with religion, but the Christian principles have been well established, and there has been a lot of denominations that are Christian denominations, you know, have come to this country and they've thrived. Also, you have Buddhists have come to this country and thrived. Hindus have come to this country and thrived. Even Islamic people have come to this country and thrived. But today, there's something really different happening, and people are opting not to have any religion or to be associated with any religion. And they've been classified as what they call nuns.
N-O-N-E-S.
N-O-N-E-S, yes.
I am none of the above. I'm a
right.
nun.
I'm none of the above. We're not talking about the Sisters of St. Joseph. We're talking about nuns. Now, what's interesting is these people are not necessarily atheists. Now, some of them are, but they say they believe in God, and they say they want to be spiritual, but they have no desire to be a part of an organized religion.
So that's really their defining characteristic, the fact that organized religion is just not interested.
That's right. And they don't want to be part of like organized doctrine. They don't want to have dogma. They want to essentially believe what they want to believe. Now, the thing that's so interesting about this is, let's just say there's always been nuns. I mean, there's always been people that didn't want to be affiliated with an organized religion, or let's say they didn't want to be affiliated with as Catholics or Lutherans or Presbyterians or Methodists. But the numbers have been really quite small in terms of, let's say, the American adult population. But what's remarkable is since the year 2000, the number has jumped significantly. And there's now, let's say, about 56 million American adults that are saying they're nuns. And the thing I think is most shocking about them, the highest majority of them are in what they call the millennial generation. And those are the people that have been born since 1996. So these are young Americans.
The younger you are, the less likely you are to want to belong to a religion.
Right. So what you're seeing is the younger generation is not coming back to the fold. And the thing that's really serious is the older generations are dying off. And so why this is such a problem, or it could be such a problem, is America, whose constitution and whose way of life almost demands that there is morality, there's people that follow law, there's people that want to believe in God, believe in an authority, that generation is dying out. And so what does it mean for society if you have a whole, let's say, country, what if it goes to 100 million, or what if it goes to, 150 million people that don't have any belief in any absolutes? They don't have a belief in, following an authoritative God. I mean, that brings big implications for our society.
So you just equated the rise of the nuns with the decline in overall morality. Is that a fair characterization, or is it possible that some of those people who say, I don't want anything to do with organized religion, but I'm still going to be a moral person?
I think you would have a portion of them that would say they definitely believe in God, and they would definitely, support, let's say, you know, authority in government. They would support, you know, authority in the police. But in terms of morals, if you look at the typical nun, for example, they would support abortion. They would support homosexual marriage. You know, some of them would get into to more of the extremes, and you know, they would support transgenderism. And so there is some real questions on where their judgment or their measurement for morality is. It's very clear that they want to pick and choose what truth they follow, and so they can establish their own morality. And we know that there are those that are atheists and nuns that they believe in infanticide. They would say that atheists are very moral people. It is kind of interesting. They, along with the Pew studies, there have been some other studies done by other sociologists, and they've analyzed the nuns and their view of spirituality. And there are a lot of them that have said that they believe that there's spiritual energy in all physical objects. A lot of them are into yoga, and a lot of them believe in reincarnation. A lot of them are into astrology. A lot of them have visited psychics. And so
it's just the smorgasbord of spiritual sounding ideas.
Right. They want to be spiritual, but they don't necessarily, let's say, want to follow a doctrine, let's say, from the Bible.
Let's just talk about causes. Do we have a sense of what it is that's driving that change? What is it about organized religion that is really, say, creating that sense of disenfranchisement or disillusionment?
If you would really look at some of the surveys and talk to the nuns themselves, they would say very definitely that it's been the visible problems that they've had in established religion. For example, they feel like there's this bloated drive to get money from people. You know, they also feel that traditional religion in this country is over-politicized. And of course, they really point fingers at the evangelical right and, you know, for their desire to get certain presidents elected. I know a lot of people believe that President Reagan was voted into office because of the conservative right. And so they take advantage of some of the real flaws that have happened. I mean, there's been these television ministries that have made this incredible amount of money, and some of their leaders have had, you know, animals that have dog bowls that are gold plated.
Mm-hmm.
And so they see that as a real flaw, and it is a flaw. And, you know, so there are some real reasons. In other words, kind of like what's happened in American traditional religion and its failings have driven these people out of the flocks.
So there's a certain amount of the criticism that you could say it's fair. It's fair criticism of organized religion.
Correct.
You look at the Catholic Church and the problems that it has had with pedophilia and other situations where people look at that and just say, wow, I don't want any part of that. And so they're just writing off the whole picture of organized religion.
That's exactly right. There, a lot of the nuns, like I said, 34% of the total number, and it is 56 million. They're young urban professionals that have been college trained, and they can see some of the fallacies, and they're tired of it. And I think there's even some honest church leaders in this country that say, you know, American religion has given God a bad name. And, you know, people have stood up and gave fire and brimstone sermons that you're going to hell and you're going to do this if you do this, 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 and this, and then turns around and the next news report, they're guilty of the same things. American religious leaders have to face that, you know, they have caused God to have a bad name.
But it's interesting, though, for a person to say, because this religious leader or because this denomination isn't fully living what it says is the way to live, therefore I'm going to throw out the entire system, or this somehow casts a bad light on the Bible or on God. That's really not a real honest way. If you're really in an honest search for the truth, the fact that people would be imperfect representatives of the truth shouldn't dissuade you from seeking that truth.
No, not really at all, because if you look at the Bible and if you really understand it, it's really a collection of histories of flawed and failed men that God worked with to help them turn their lives around. You know, so the Bible is full of things. Abraham, one of the greatest patriarchs of all time, had his mistakes. Jacob, certainly, the Bible is, his story is just replete with mistakes that he made. There's only been one man that lived on this earth and never made a mistake, and that was Jesus Christ. But Paul made his mistakes. Peter made his mistakes. But that doesn't change the fact that what they taught was the truth that God gave them to teach. And, you know, that's really where people's focus has to be. And it's so easy to point a finger at a religious leader and say, well, you know, you made that mistake, therefore I'm going to go off on my own. That just doesn't cut it with God.
Well, in a way, you look at the fruits. What are these people going to? Say the person who says, I don't want any part of organized religion, where are they fleeing to? And then you start to see, well, look, this, they're really not interested in truth. They're really interested in just following their own heart, their own ideas.
It is interesting. There was one sociologist did a study about, I think it was titled something like What's in My Heart. And he was interviewing some nuns. And I'm not talking about N-U-N-S. I'm talking about N-O-N-E-S, just to get that clear. But this woman he interviewed, her name was Sheila. And she is unaffiliated, doesn't belong to any religion. And she assured him, oh, I definitely believe in God. And he asked her, he said, well, what is your faith? And she says, well, I listen to the own little voice in my head. It's called Sheilaism. And so they're not going anywhere, but they are following their own thoughts, their own thinking. And like I said, that they're picking and choosing what they want. And, you know, some people would even say, well, I like this part from Buddhism and I like this part from Hinduism, but I still kind of like Christ. And they'll try and murk it all together or mash it all together. And it's their religion. It's a religion they form by themselves.
They're unwilling to trust another person. They're unwilling to trust a man, the head of a religion or a minister or pastor, whatever the case, but they're very willing to trust themselves.
Exactly.
So the problem with trusting a human heart, it's the same, isn't it? And whether you're trusting someone else or trusting yourself, you're still trusting somebody who's very fallible.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The people that become nuns, they don't like to say things like sin. They would like to relegate it all to like mistake. You know, instead of being sinners, they're mistakers. And so you see, when you get off on your own thinking, well, you know, if you murder someone, well, there could be a good excuse for it. Well, at the moment, my heart said do it. But, wow, that was a mistake.
Right. Well, we definitely see that kind of moral climate in the United States today, where just about anything, you can explain just about anything. Once you throw out absolutes, then you're really kind of walking around in Never Never Land.
That's right.
Well, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it. Looking forward to reading your article in this coming Trumpet.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
There's a lot of debate right now about the role of law and government in our lives. In America, the government is enforcing our laws selectively. They're making exceptions. They're exempting themselves from certain laws. We're even seeing our Constitution under attack. They see it as an obstacle, something to work around or ignore. Here and in Britain, the government is taking more and more power to itself, and freedom and independence are being eroded. Now, this trend is undermining a pillar principle of these two nations, a wonderful revolutionary idea that was codified 800 years ago, an idea that underpins a great deal of the freedoms that we enjoy. June 15th marked the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. This is a legal document that was signed back in 1215 in England. And Richard Palmer and Sam Livingston are working on a documentary about this extraordinary charter. And they say that the Magna Carta could be more relevant now than ever. So I talked with them via Skype at Edstone, England, about why we need to remember this history. What is the Magna Carta?
Magna Carta basically does two very important things. It is a foundational document for establishing the rule of law. To give some background into the origin of Magna Carta, King John was a very unpopular king. He did a whole bunch of things that his barons didn't like. They rose up against him and they forced him to sign this document. And so one of the key things that he did that the barons didn't like was selling justice. So if there was a big court case going on, the king would just come down on the side of whoever paid him the most. And so one of the key things Magna Carta does was establish rule of law, establish due process of law, put in place the legal basis for things like trial by jury. Maybe not in the full way that we know it today, but the idea that somebody is tried by their peers instead of the arbitrary whim of the king. And so, as in the words of Daniel Hanen, who wrote a book on this kind of thing, what the Great Charter enshrined in statutory form was that the supreme power in the land was not the executive, but a fixed set of legal principles, and that in any clash between the two, the law would prevail over the government. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing that it began the process of doing was that of push towards popular sovereignty. And the 1215 version of Magna Carta especially had provisions along the lines of no taxation without representation, that if you wanted to raise taxes, you had to go to the people that you were raising those taxes from and get their permission. And then this principle was then used throughout British and American history and jurisprudence to transfer more power away from the king and make that more diffuse and into the people.
How revolutionary are these concepts in the context of the time in which they were written? You know, how different was this from, say, what you were getting in other countries around the world?
The principles of the Magna Carta were around well before it was signed. There were the principles from Edward the Confessor, but the Magna Carta was significant in that it was the first time the rule of law was formalized, that it was signed, and that it was agreed to. And that's what made it significant. That's what made it different from anything to this point in time. It wasn't something that you particularly saw in other areas. It's really a quality that you see a lot in just Anglo-Saxon peoples. And as you watch them come over to the United States and you just follow it back through Northern Europe, it's primarily something that you just see in this area of the world. And it's something that present day United States and Britain export to the rest of the world. It's primarily an idea that is American and British.
And just to add to that, Magna Carta has kind of a long background within Britain, and it was after a process of development and came after a long tradition of rule of law within Britain, but this was very different to a lot of other places in Europe.
So how much did this expression of law and this idea that everyone is subject to the same law and the people have certain legal protections against exploitation on the part of their rulers, how big of a role did this play in Britain's rise as a power? Basically, this came into being right about the time that Britain started to take off as a power.
Well, that's one of the qualities that Niall Ferguson talks about in his book, Civilization. He says the rule of law was one of the things that allowed Britain to become such a great power. And he says that because it establishes social order, people have rights, property, they have property rights, etc. And those things can't just be taken away. And once you have those things set in place and established, then you can start becoming more of a formalized nation. You can become more powerful. You've got order and you've got structure. You just don't have a king or a monarch just running the show the way he wants it done. There are laws that govern things, and it was something that Britain, from that point on, you saw, especially at the height of the empire, that they exported to a lot of their colonies, and you saw the benefits that that brought to those areas as well.
If you're living in an arbitrary society, there's much less incentive for you to go out to produce and to get rich, because if you can get rich and then the king can take it all from you, that's a bit of a bummer. If you know that you're going to be able to keep it, then you've got a lot more incentive to put your life on the line, to work hard, to take risks. And so it leads to a much more dynamic society.
Well, that independent spirit that you're describing there, that seems to characterize America more than any other nation. How much does America owe to the principles that were established in the Magna Carta?
A huge amount. Sam and I, last week, we went to an exhibit at the British Museum. And what they had there is they had two of the four remaining original copies of Magna Carta. And then right with that, they had the Bill of Rights and they had Thomas Jefferson's handwritten, his own version of the Declaration of Independence. They just did a great job of tracing right from Magna Carta through to the early state charters of those people that first went out to colonize America, and people like William Penn, who set up the states before they became independent. Those early state charters and constitutions all often made allusions to Magna Carta, and then it just kept going through to the Declaration, the Bill of Rights, etc.
Yeah, Daniel Hannan talks about that in his book quite a bit. He says, in some ways, Americans actually associate more with the Magna Carta than the British do, in the sense that at the time of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights was going on, you have a mood that's more similar to what was going on in 1215 with the Magna Carta. You have Americans who feel that they don't have a say in the government. They're being governed by this King George III, who isn't sympathetic to what they feel. So Hannan talks about how even when you're studying law today in America, you're more likely to go back to that founding document, the Magna Carta, and studying the principles of that. Like Richard was saying, the formative documents, Maryland and Virginia, for example, when they were becoming colonies, parts of their constitution almost sound exactly like certain articles taken right out of the Magna Carta.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We're talking with Richard Palmer and Sam Livingston, who are working on a documentary about the Magna Carta. This is the 800th anniversary of this founding legal document. This is somewhat of a revolutionary concept, the rule of law and some of these founding legal principles that you find in this document in light of most of human history. But you say that the roots of the Magna Carta are actually quite ancient.
Right, and I'll quite a bit from a book that I read a few years ago, and it really astounded me almost when I came across it in this book. The book is called The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, and it's by a Harvard professor, David Landes. And what he does in that book is he tries to answer the question, you know, why are some nations today rich? Why are some poor? What is it that makes it happen? Very similar to what Niall Ferguson attempts to do in his book, Civilization. And unsurprisingly, he cites rule of law and this principle that we get from Magna Carta as being one of the great things that makes a nation rich. What I wasn't expecting coming from a Harvard professor was where he traces the roots of that rule of law back to, and he traces it back to the Bible and actually traces it all the way back to Moses. And he quotes the book of Numbers in Numbers chapter 16, when Korah leads a rebellion against Moses. And when Moses defends himself, Moses says, well, whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I stolen? Who have I defrauded? And he makes the point that in any society in the world at that time, it wouldn't have made any sense for the leader of the nation to make that statement. Because in all those other societies, if the leader wanted your ox, he took your ox. If he wanted your money, he took it. If he wanted your donkey, he took it. But this idea that it was clear that Moses was under the law, this secular Harvard professor says that actually this is quite revolutionary. And there's more in there, of course, that he doesn't talk about. For example, we have, you know, in the book of Deuteronomy, the king, it says that when you set a king up, the king has to write his own copy of the law in his own handwriting. He has to go and write it out, which just, again, a major symbol right at the start of a king's reign that he is subject to that law. And so Landes traces that principle of rule of law all the way back to the Bible. And what's interesting is he even mentions groups like the Waldenses and groups that were very Bible-believing as spreading this this principle of rule of law, while the Catholic Church kept the Bible in Latin and didn't want to read it, partly for that reason.
Phenomenal history, and it is amazing that the biblical concept of governance so closely parallels the checks on power that you see in British history and in American history, and how important those checks are in terms of just limiting the ability of human nature to affect the lives of the people who are being governed. So what is the danger in forgetting this history? Why is it so important that we remember this 800th anniversary and that we remember these principles that are set up in this amazing document?
Well, one point Ferguson has made since writing his book Civilization, and he identified rule of law as one of the key things that made the West great, is he has warned that we're moving away from that. And he wrote some quite striking articles a few years ago warning that things like this could lead to a catastrophic decline. And he has this You know, this great phrase that he says that we're moving away from rule of law to rule of lawyers.
Yeah, I was just looking at some quotes from the historian Paul Johnson. He wrote an article that we quote in the No Freedom Without Law book. This article he wrote is called No Law Without Order, No Freedom Without Law. And he makes a statement in there that I'll just read it for you. He's talking about the rule of law. He says, "It is the same law for everyone, everywhere. Kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself are subject to it. If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse." And he goes on to reference Rome and ancient Greece, and he calls that the grand lesson of antiquity, was that when you begin to make exceptions to the rule of law is when you see it begin to crumble. The Constitution, these things can be successful because you have people who are following it, who are submitting to it, and are staying under the rule of law, that common law that is for everyone. And you begin to see these societies start to crumble when, as Johnson says, those exceptions are made and certain people feel they can interpret it the way that they want to, and they're governing the way they see fit rather than the way the law says to do it. So that's where it becomes relevant for today, is trying to maintain that same order, maintain the rule of law and keeping everyone underneath it as well.
So instead, though, we see now things like the Obama administration, you know, more and more saying, well, we're going to make this law, but you guys don't have to keep it. We're going to make an exception for this group of people, or we're going to make an exception here, or this law was on the statute book 10, 15 years ago. We're going to choose not to apply it.
Not to mention all of the times when they're exempting themselves from keeping the laws that are on the books.
Right. We're just not going to enforce it against ourselves. And yeah, it is becoming a lot more of a fluid and a loose principle rather than an absolute. And this history does show us that that is profoundly dangerous.
Well, we certainly are becoming a case study in what happens when you lose the rule of law in a lot of ways. Gentlemen, I really appreciate you reminding us of this wonderful history and this very important document. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate the illumination you've given us.
Great. Thanks. Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour.
It's time for Q&A. I have our social media manager, David V. Hill, here with me in the studio. How you doing, David?
Doing great on this beautiful day.
David takes questions submitted to us from online, through email, from the website. He fires them at me, and I try to answer. So, David, what questions do we have this week?
Okay, for this week, we have a question that relates to your commentary at the end of a Trumpet Hour. It was talking about mustard on a hamburger, and you're just telling your children to eat the hamburger with the mustard, just be content with what you have. And so this question comes from Francois. He says, "My common sense would tell me that this scripture is a general rule to those who have all the basics a human would be in need of. When I look at all those who are trapped in war, hunger, and poverty, be content with what you have surely wouldn't apply to them."
I guess that's a valid point. I have to admit, I wasn't thinking about people in war and hunger and poverty when I wrote that. I was thinking about those of us who are better off and living in more prosperous conditions. But you know, the beauty of those spiritual principles is that they are universal. They really do apply to everybody. Sure, it's a whole lot harder to count your blessings when you're in a trial, but that is actually a very consistent message in the Bible. It says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. And, you know, what I kind of built that commentary around, the Apostle Paul was the one who said, you know, be content. He's the one who said, I've learned to be content in whatever state I've been found in. And you look at his life, he experienced all kinds of trials, serious trials. He was beaten and put in prison and stoned and shipwrecked and left for dead. So if Paul could say, you know, be content no matter what condition you find yourself in, then I'd say, well, I don't think there's ever really a point in our life where we could say, well, obviously, you know, that doesn't apply to me, because I mean, I'm going through really, really tough times right now.
Yeah. And I think too, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't try to better yourself. You know, if you're trapped in poverty, hunger, try to get out of it. Being content doesn't mean just stay in that state.
Oh no, that's absolutely true. Yeah, and I didn't say anything to try to suggest that that's what you should do.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions?
Yes, we do have one last question, and that is in regards to consuming our shows online. The question is about whether or not our shows are downloadable.
I believe they are downloadable. You would actually know whether they're downloadable. Maybe you can take this question.
Oh, sure. Yes. So we are in the process of distributing our programs to various places. And right now you can actually download our shows at kpcg.fm. If you go to our navigation bar on top, you can go into shows. And when you get into the specific show that you want, those shows will be displayed and you can actually download some versions of those. There's also iTunes. You can go to iTunes if you have a device that lets you do that. You can go there and at least subscribe, and then they'll be there for you on your iPhone or tablet, whatever device you have, and you can just listen to it whenever you have the time. We do have other places we're looking into to be able to provide that for you as well, but those are the two places right now. On kpcg.fm at the specific show pages that we have, and then through iTunes.
Fantastic. You did a great job answering that question. Maybe we should switch this around. I'll ask the questions and you give the answers from now on.
Well, we could try that, but I don't think the listeners would enjoy it.
You can send us your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. David, I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you. I had a great time.
It's time for today's last word.
Let's assume you don't consider yourself a finished product. You want to become a better person, kinder, healthier, smarter, more productive, more outgoing, more successful. Well, to do that, consider this bit of simple, potent advice from a highly credible source, the Bible. It's in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3, and it says, "Endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ." There is hardness that benefits you. We naturally tend to snuggle up in our comfort zones, but in order to grow, we need the challenges and afflictions that life presents. We have to endure difficulty, even embrace it. Now, God knows this. Anciently, with the nation of Israel, he didn't shower these people with comfort and ease. He afflicted them. Moses told them, "And you shall remember all the way which the Eternal your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to prove you to know what was in your heart." Challenges reveal your heart. They teach you about yourself. They expose your weaknesses. They show you where you need to be stronger. The devil wants to entrap us in materialism and comforts. And if we give in and grow too comfortable, we tend to become afraid of discomfort to the point where we'll do anything to avoid it. We shy away from things that might hurt, even good, noble things like hard work, sacrificing for your family, standing up to peer pressure. If your goal is to remain comfortable at all costs, you will never do those things. Our industrial age has eliminated many of the challenges that were built into the human experience for millennia. So it's no surprise that we also have epidemic obesity, bad health, people glutted on entertainment, people unwilling to work. There was a recent poll that revealed that 20% of U.S. households have nobody working. Now, laziness, stagnation, these things tend to feed on themselves and destroy character. Everything that helps you grow is uncomfortable. Everything. Learning something new, meeting people, eating healthier, exercise, building a new habit, changing your routine to introduce something that's good for you. These things are all hard. Your mind and body want to resist. That's what makes it a fight, and that's why it works. These things break you out of complacency and lead to growth. They make you better. They make you stronger. And when you live at the edges of your comfort zone, that zone expands. The great men of the Bible, the great men and women of the Bible understood this. That's why Paul was willing to endure terrible adversity with a positive attitude. He said, "We glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation works patience." And he said, "I take pleasure in infirmities. I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake." Paul didn't just endure hardness, he learned to embrace it. And you see the same message in the writings of the Apostle Peter and the Apostle James. Recognizing the benefits that you gain from challenges enables you to smile through trial. When that hard thing comes, you can do what comes naturally. You can whine, moan, complain, lose your cool, hit the snooze button, or you can embrace hardness. Don't think negatively about how much that physical workout or that spiritual trial hurts. Think about the thrill of the challenge. Focus on the fact that you can do more now than you could last month or last year. You could never grow if life were always easy. In order to keep growing, you must get comfortable with being uncomfortable. What do you fear? Well, don't turn from it. Tackle it. And as in exercise, so in life. There's a difference between good pain and bad pain. Bad pain results from mistakes and causes injury. Instead of avoiding all pain, learn the difference and avoid only bad pain. Embrace good pain and the gains it brings. In the last letter he wrote, 2 Timothy, Paul wrote this: endure afflictions. That's what he had done. He had done that through his whole life. He wrote, "I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith." Paul described his Christian life as a fight. He didn't say, "I've lived a good life." He said, "I have fought a good fight." Physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, you are capable of far more than you think. Let God lead you in a life of growing, overcoming, conquering, and do it with a smile on your face. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. Send us your thoughts or your questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus. Just search Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Dennis Leap, Richard Palmer, and Sam Livingston. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson: a government big enough to give you everything you want is strong enough to take everything you have. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.